Praise to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. All glories to Vidaya. Krishna Prasai with Lashima Mativadaya to Swami Tinayan. Namaste Sansati Devi. Gauranga Manivatani Nivasesa Samivani Vasakajanati Satani. Vandayam Sri Guru Sri Utapadakamalam Sri Guru and Vaishnavam Sachar. Sri Rupam Sagarjatam Saganaraganatam Vikam Samsajivam. Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padam Saganava Vitashri Shakam Vitamstra Vanchakapa Chubishaki Pasandavya Vatapti Janam Pavani Vavajra Namo Namo Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. May 15th, 2014, in Radadesh, Belgium, reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 6, Chapter 5, Narada Muni cursed by Prajapati Daksha. This is the rumination of Daksha's sons after hearing the metaphor spoken by Narada. Text 18. Aishvaryam Shastram Utsrijya. Bandamokshanudarshanam. Vivikta Param Agnaya. Kimasat Karma Bir Babet. Question.
Aishvaryam Shastram Utsrijya.
Aishvaryam, bringing understanding of God or Krishna consciousness. Shastram, the Vedic literature. Utsrijya, giving up. Banda, of bondage. Moksha, and of liberation. Anudarshanam, informing about the ways. Vivikta Padam, distinguishing spirit from matter. Agnaya, not knowing. Kimasat karma bhavet. What can be the use of temporary fruitive activities? Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. Narada Muni had spoken of a swan. That swan is explained in this verse. The Vedic literature shastras vividly describe how to understand the Supreme Lord, the source of all material and spiritual energy. Indeed, they elaborately explain these two energies. The swan, Hamsa, is one who discriminates between matter and spirit, who accepts the essence of everything, and who explains the means of bondage and the means of liberation. The words of scriptures consist of variegated vibrations. If a foolish rascal leaves aside the study of these shastras to engage in temporary activities, what will be the result? Purport. The Krishna consciousness movement is very eager to present Vedic literature in modern languages, especially Western languages such as English, French, and German. So it would have been perfect if Prabhupada said English, French, and Dutch, right? Pretty close. The leaders of the Western world, the Americans and Europeans, have become the idols of modern civilization because the Western people are very sophisticated in temporary activities for the advancement of material civilization. A sane man, however, can see that all such grand activities, although perhaps very important for temporary life, have nothing to do with eternal life. The entire world is imitating the materialistic civilization of the West, and therefore the Krishna consciousness movement is very much interested in giving the Western people knowledge by translating the original Sanskrit Vedic literatures into Western languages. So why does Prabhupada say we're very interested in translating the Shastra into Western languages?
For the knowledge to be available for everyone.
But why particularly the Western languages like English, French, and German?
Because they are kind of ruling the world.
Because these are the people that are ruling the world, and people will follow them. The word Vivikta Padam, I wanted to ask you, Radhikrishna, because I was preparing this class in the car, going through Germany. What does Vivikta Padam literally mean? What's the literal meaning?
Differentiated words.
Differentiated word, okay. So padam here means like syllables?
Well, it can mean two things. Either it can mean differentiated words or syllables and lines, or it can mean words about differentiation, which is how Prabhupada is taking it here.
Yes, so Vivikta means differentiating, and pada, which usually means step, can also mean words or syllables?
Words or lines.
Oh, okay. So words in the verse or lines in the verse. Okay. The word Vivikta Padam refers to the path of logical discourses concerning the aim of life. If one does not discuss that which is important in life, one is put into darkness and must struggle for existence. What, then, is the benefit of his advancement in knowledge? The people of the West are seeing their students becoming hippies, despite gorgeous arrangements for university education. The Krishna consciousness movement, however, is trying to convert misguided, drug-addicted students to the service of Krishna and engage them in the best welfare activities for human society. Aishvaryam shastram uchrijya bandha mokshan darshanam vivikta padam agnaya kimasat karma birbhavit. Narada Muni has spoken of a swan. That swan is explained in this verse. The Vedic literature shastras vividly describe how to understand the Supreme Lord, the source of all material and spiritual energy. Indeed, they elaborately explain these two energies. The swan, Hamsa, is one who discriminates between matter and spirit, who accepts the essence of everything, and who explains the means of bondage and the means of liberation. The words of scriptures consist of variegated vibrations. If a foolish rascal leaves aside the study of these shastras to engage in temporary activities, what will be the result? So here there's many verses that end in Kimasat Karma Birbhavet, that after looking at the metaphor, each section of the metaphor individually, the Daksha's sons came to the conclusion, what is the use of doing something that's temporary? And here Srila Prabhupada is talking about the combination of East and West, the combination of the temporary and the eternal. So it's interesting here because Srila Prabhupada is saying that especially we're very eager to present Vedic literatures in modern languages such as English, French, and German because these countries are the idols, he says. He uses the word idol, I-D-O-L, not ideal, the idol, like people think we're worshipping idols. So the idol of modern civilization because Western people are very sophisticated in temporary activities for the advancement of material civilization. So I'm really meditating on this. So Prabhupada's saying, all right, you in the West, in France, Germany, UK, America, Belgium too, can we include Belgium? That we're very advanced in enjoying the material world, and that's a fact. We are. Yes, what does Prabhupada say here? Very sophisticated There's very sophisticated, Prabhupada uses the word here, sophisticated. You know what sophisticated is? Elegant. Someone who's sophisticated, very high class. So very elegant, sophisticated ways of enjoying life. And therefore everyone is, oh, I want that, I want that, I want that. So these people are the ones who, if they get Vedic knowledge, then the rest of the world will follow them in Vedic knowledge. Why? Why would the rest of the world then follow in Vedic knowledge? You really think about this kind of deeply. What is Prabhupada saying here? Is he asking those in the Western countries to give up their sophisticated materialistic activities? In fact, what would happen if we did so?
No one would follow.
No, exactly. It's a very deep thing here, isn't it? So if those of us in the Western countries who are now the idols of the world, if we stop being very sophisticated in our material activities, we would cease to be the idols of the world. What is it that Srila Prabhupada's asking? What is it Srila Prabhupada's hoping will happen by giving translations of the Vedic literatures to people who are very sophisticated in material activities and who are thus the idols of the world? What's he hoping will happen? Yes. Ah, but what will that mean? Yes?
To add Krishna and not to give
them. Exactly. To add Krishna. So Prabhupada gave the analogy, the metaphor. Narada Muni here is speaking a metaphor. What was Prabhupada's metaphor of this addition? Yeah?
I think it's the eye, the head, and the legs.
Yes, very good. The blind man and the lame man. The blind man and the lame man. So one man can see, but he can't walk. Another man can walk, but he can't see. So who can walk, but can't see? The West. The West can walk. The people in the West can walk very well, but they don't know where they're going. Prabhupada quoted, I forget who it was. Maybe it was Gandhi, who first visited the UK. And he was saying, this is such a small island and the vehicles are going so fast, they're probably just going to go into the ocean. You know, where are they going? Prabhupada would see the runners. Someplace we were driving in the last few days, I saw a whole bunch of runners in some race. And where are they going? You know, where are they going? Recently when I was in California, there was one of my family members that was participating in a race, and it was a race, it was a circular oval, it was an oval track, and in the middle was a grassy stretch. And at places along the track, they were throwing colors. Everybody, when you get in the race, you pay some money, which goes to charity, and also I'm sure pays for the race, and you get a bag of colors, and at the beginning everybody's throwing colors, and then at certain places along the race, they all throw colors. And then at the end of the race, there's a band on stage and they're singing music and playing music and people are dancing and throwing colors. And I thought, this is, you know, kingdom of God without God. They're circumambulating something. They're doing a parikrama of just some grass, you know. Instead of doing a parikrama of a deity or parikrama of a holy dom, they're doing a parikrama just of some ordinary grass. And instead of having a kirtan to Krishna's names, they're jumping up and down. And they were jumping up and down and dancing, you know, just to some... whatever, you know, let's have illicit sex and enjoy the world, or whatever they were saying, I don't know, whatever they were saying. And they're trying to enjoy in what should be used for Krishna in a mundane way. So all you have to do is add Krishna to that. That's all you'd have to do. You know, just have a kirtan on the stage and put a temple in the middle of the track, you know, and have everybody give donations for Sankirtan Yagya. And it was just really quite interesting. I was really finding it fascinating. So Prabhupada wants this to show what is this perfect life materially and spiritually. Now, of course, the sons of Daksha who are speaking this verse are only going to go for spiritual life. They're going to walk away completely from material life. They're going to take sannyas. Taking sannyas means dying. Yes? The four stages of life are, first you go to school, you're a student, then you have a family and a career, then you retire, and then you die. And the difference between, one of the differences between the materialistic way that people go to school, get married, have a career, retire, and die, is that in the ashram system, you die before you physically die. You socially die first, and then you physically die. That's the main difference. But Srila Prabhupada, talking about having these sort of systems in society, talks about a prosperous life. Right? These sons of Daksha, they're just dying. They're going right. They're going straight from the student life to the dead life. They're skipping the grihastha life. Prabhupada says the brahmachari, after the brahmachari ashram, actually says right in the verse in the seventh canto, can go directly to the grihastha ashram or the vanaprastha ashram or the sannyasa ashram. Very unusual that anyone stays in the brahmachari ashram whole life. Somebody may stay brahmachari whole life, but to stay in the brahmachari ashram. I'm sure you see in the university some perpetual students, right? They get 2-3 PhDs and they do postdoctoral research and they never teach, right? They're just researching and studying. So that's like someone who stays in the brahmachari ashram whole life. But generally, the brahmachari goes into the grihastha ashram or the vanaprastha ashram or the sannyasa ashram. Of course, generally into the grihastha ashram. So these sons of Daksha, they're going straight to the sannyasa ashram. They're skipping. They're not trying to have a life that's both materially and spiritually prosperous. Kimasat kamavirabhavet. What's the use of any temporary activities? Let's go straight for sannyas and let's just die. Sannyas means death. And you're dying before dying. And everyone is supposed to die before dying at the end. If you die before dying at the end, then death is not painful. Because why is death painful? It's not so much because the body's in pain. In fact, your body may be in much more pain due to some accident or disease during your life from which you don't die. But the real pain of death is subtle. The real pain of death is, oh, I have to leave everything. I have to leave all my investments, basically. Like Prabhupada says, when the residents of Vrindavan saw Krishna and the Kaliya serpent, they had everything invested in Krishna, therefore they were almost dying. So, you know, when there's an economic crash, some people commit suicide because all their investments are finished. So we've invested in this body, we've invested in our family relationships, we've invested in our education for this body, our things for this body. And sannyas is you leave that. You leave sarvapati vinirbhuktan tadparatena nirmala rishikesha rishikena sevana bhakshu chuchay. Okay, I'm no longer a German, French, or English. I'm no longer a man or woman. I'm no longer this person's mother, father, son, uncle, whatever. Like Jesus said to one disciple who was at his father's funeral, let the dead bury their dead and come with me. So that's what they were going to. They were going to complete abnegation of anything other than spirituality. And they were doing this at a very young age, and we'll find the doctor got quite upset by this. And he said, I don't think they were ready. Narada said, I think they were ready. And doctor said, no, I don't think they were ready. You know, they'll fall. And we've, had, of course, had experience in our movement of so many people. I think our sannyas fall down rate is 87%, pretty sure. So we've had so many people who thought they were ready. You know, when they were 22, 24, okay, I'm going to die now. Even we had one godbrother, Udalami, who was told by the doctors that he was going to die. And he wasn't married for a year or so, his wife was pregnant. And he went to Prabhupada and he said, the doctors have said I'm going to die. And Prabhupada said, okay, then you can go to Mayapur and chant, you know, at least 64 rounds a day. And he gave him Babaji initiation. So then while he was in Mayapur, his parents talked to some doctors who said they could cure him. And so they contacted him in Mayapur and said, we found a cure. And at the point he gave up his Babaji. And then Prabhupada said, I'm not going to give anybody else this Babaji. So people may think like that, you know, well, I can give up all temporary things at a young age. But most people can't do that. I mean, of course, if everybody could do that, that would be lovely. Like people would ask Srila Prabhupada, what would happen if everyone immediately became Krishna conscious? Then the whole world would stop. And Prabhupada said, well, let the world stop. It's like saying, suppose all the criminals immediately became honest citizens. You know, who would pay the salaries of the prison wardens? Let them look for another job. Let the prison close. You know, if everybody became healthy, then who would support all the doctors? It would be wonderful if all the hospitals and the clinics and the prisons and Cedric could close. So if the whole material world could close, that would be wonderful. But Prabhupada would also say, that's not going to happen. And we find even those of us who take to Krishna consciousness, you know, even if we don't formally take sannyas, many of us, when we come, we think, okay, we're going to be like Daksha's sons, and we're just going to kimasat karma bir bhavet, finish. Who cares about anything? I'll just have, you know, two dhotis or two saris, and I just go out all day in Sankirtan and share one room with 12 people and keep my things in a box and kimasat karma bir bhavet, it's all done. You know, I'm dead to the world. I never see my parents again. I never see my brothers and sisters again. I don't even remember their names and the world. Basically, it's like taking sannyas. But we see again, most people cannot maintain that. I mean, that's just simply our experience, that no matter how strict and serious people are in their Krishna consciousness and how dedicated they are, they can't maintain that. And if the most serious and sincere and dedicated people find that they need to go through the very scientific and very intelligent ashram system which Krishna designed, then what to speak of the general populace? Can we really expect the general populace to immediately all take sannyas? We were just reading in Munich about how in Satya Yuga there were no varnas. You didn't have to have any varna because your fruit was growing on the trees. You didn't have to do anything to earn a livelihood. And there was no need, that means of government. There was no need of government. There was no need of crafts. There was no need of agriculture. There was not even need of a separate category of teachers. But those people were very elevated. We're not so elevated. So what do we need? We need a model of both material and spiritual success. That's what we need. The vast majority of the members of our Hare Krishna movement need that. I mean, I think we can honestly say that even most of our sannyasis need that to some extent. I think we can say that honestly. Can we say that honestly? I mean, even most of our sannyasis and vanaprastas, you know, you've been in the vanaprastha ashram a long time, yes? How long?
10 years.
So at least 10 years. Let's see, I've been in the vanaprastha ashram for 18 years. So even, you know, us and you, Rupa Mandiri, how long have you been in the vanaprastha ashram?
21 years.
And you?
17.
17? You have any other vanaprastas or sannyasis? You, Mahalakshmi?
17.
So even those of us in the vanaprastha and sannyas ashram, have we stopped all material life? Are we living like the sannyasis and the vanaprastas described in the Bhagavatam? I don't think so. I was just reading this the other day. You know, and you live outside. The traditional vanaprastha lives outside. They have a cave only to keep the sacred fire. And outside, you subject yourself to the wind and the snow. Anybody ready to do that? And you're not supposed to eat, you know, anything except grains ripened by the sunshine and fruit ripened on the tree. Nothing cooked, nothing cultivated by agriculture. Are we ready to do that? I don't think so. And the sannyasis are supposed to travel. I mean, people say to me all the time, Urmila, you travel so light. I just have one little carry-on. But the sannyasi is supposed to travel with just a danda and a kamandalu. That's all. They don't even get a carry-on. Of course, Mahaprabhu traveled in South India with four sets of clothes. He had someone carrying four sets of clothes and a few things. Even the Buddhist monks, they have one bag. They actually call it a Buddha bag. And the regulation for some of the monks, they have to travel with only as much as they can fit into that bag. You know, something like what the airlines have now. You can travel, you have to have this size and this weight. So the Buddhist monk, they give them a regulation bag. Okay, you have to fit everything in there. But the traditional sannyas was really, you really died. You really walked away from everything. I was talking to Sitala about, she was talking to me about, she went on the Vrindavan Parikrama, one of the first Vrindavan Parikramas, you know, decades ago, when they didn't know, kind of like the way you travel, where they didn't know where they were going. Maybe you should do that. But then now they're more sophisticated, now it's probably so sophisticated, now they're more sophisticated. But Sitala was telling me that when they were doing this Parikrama, they didn't know where they were going to stay. They were just walking. They didn't know where they were going to get drinking water. They didn't know where they were going to get food. They didn't know where they were going to stay. They didn't know where they were going. They knew they were going to the holy places, but they didn't know how far they would go or whatever. And she said that after doing that, just, you know, a few days, she said the first few days were very difficult. But after a few days, it became ecstatic. Because you were always just, Krishna, 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 what are you going to do? Where are you going to give me? You know, you just let everything go and depend on Krishna. So people will do that for a month. But if you said to someone, do that for the rest of your life, right? How many people are prepared to do that? Again, even the really serious Mangal Aarti every day, 16 rounds, 3 Gayatris, 4 regulative principles, only eating food cooked by devotees, reading Prabhupada's books every day, you know, no computer games, whatever they're called. Yeah. Even the really strict devotees, they're not willing to do that. And even the devotees who go to Vrindavan and Mayapur, I mean, honestly, there are a few. There are a few, like a Sat devotee who just left his body in Vrindavan. What's his name? Radha something, remember what his name is? Anyway, he lived like that. He lived like, you know, really Brijbasi style, barefoot in the winter and living in some little shed. But, you know, most of us, we go to Vrindavan and we want to stay in Ananda Krishna Van and MBT, and we want our air conditioning in the summer and our heat in the winter. And yes? Right? We want sophisticated, intemporary activities for the advancement of civilization. Prabhupada says here, a sane man can see that all grand activities, although perhaps very important for temporary life, and I read that, I thought, perhaps? Prabhupada, perhaps? No, they're very important. What is this perhaps you're saying, Srila Prabhupada? So we're all thinking it's very important. You know, if there's no electricity, we become very disturbed. What will I do with that electricity? What will I do with no hot water, no electricity, no internet? What will I do? How will I live? So most of us, I mean, as in most, 99.9999999% of us need some example of both material and spiritual living. And indeed, Prabhupada talks about this, that in Vedic society, which was Krishna conscious, people had a prosperous life. Even in Satya Yuga, when the only Varna was Hamsa, people were living a materially prosperous life. Like Prabhupada says, Hawaii is a remnant of the previous yuga. So you go to, you know, in Hawaii, you don't need, if you wanted to, you actually could live like a vanaprastha in Hawaii. You really could. You really could live in the woods. There's clear water you can bathe in. It's never too hot. It's never too cold. There's wild avocados and coconuts and guavas and bananas and anything you can ask for growing on the trees. You know, even when it rains, it's not cold. I mean, you just take a rain shower, it's not a problem. So you can actually live like that. In former ages, people could live like that. But that's a very nice life, is my point. That's a very pleasant life. It's a very opulent material life. It's a very healthy life. So throughout the scriptures, Prabhupada's talking about how that if you have a Krishna-conscious society, it's materially prosperous. Does Prabhupada ever say that under Maharaj Yudhisthira, under Lord Ramachandra, everybody was in poverty, just living in the woods with only a kamandalu? Does he say that? No, everything was very prosperous. And of course we read about Vrindavan when Krishna's on the earth, and it's so prosperous that in their festivals they're throwing around yogurt and butter. They weren't just throwing around colors. You know, they're throwing around milk products. I mean, I remember, I don't know if I should tell this story or not, but I remember Gita Nagari, I used to make the yogurt every day. So you have a 3-gallon metal container of milk, and then the pots, you know, like this big, on top of a stove. So you have to lift this 3-gallon container up above your head and pour it into the pot. And I did it every day except one. When I just slipped and all the milk, all 3 gallons of milk went on the floor. And just at that moment, just exactly at that moment, the head of the barn, Devaki Nandan, walked into the kitchen. Right at that moment, he looked at me and he said, "That's liquid religion." I was like, oh my God. Yeah, but they were actually throwing milk around in Vrindavan. Or Maharaja Yudhisthira's Rajasuya Yoga. They're throwing it around. There was nobody going, what's that milk doing on the floor? They were throwing around yogurt and butter. There was so much. There was so much opulence. So many times devotees have this idea that if we're really going to become Krishna conscious, we all have to live in poverty, and we all have to live in, you know, be deprived. And I really think that this comes somewhat maybe from other traditions, the idea that just like suffer your whole life and then hopefully you're going to go to heaven. I mean, we have to perform austerity. That's a fact. But for us in Kali Yuga, you know, four regulative principles, 16 rounds, getting up early is a lot of austerity for most people. That's enough for most people. In fact, frankly, for most people, that's way over the top. And that's just as extreme austerity at the present time as being in cold water in the winter and surrounding yourself by fire in the summer. Right? I mean, after you're in the Krishna consciousness movement for a while, it's not an austerity anymore. You don't even notice it. But for the regular materialistic people, these things are huge austerity. And we find, again, so many people who try to do it and then they fail in so many ways. So we need examples of somebody who's materially and spiritually successful. Both. We need both examples. We need these examples in individuals. We need these examples in societies. And frankly, you don't see this in very many places. You tend to see one or the other. You tend to see places like India, which are losing their spiritual success. And they're certainly not materially successful. India does not have a sophisticated arrangement for temporary activities. Very unsophisticated. I mean, down to how you put your wires in the wall to turn on your light, you know, there's no plug at the end of your wires. The bare wires, and you just stick them into the wall. You know, and they're just hanging the electric wires outside from the trees, and the monkeys jump on them, and you know, the power's out. Oh, why is the power out? Oh, the monkeys are jumping on the line, you know. That's not what you'd call very sophisticated. And even in the cities, it's like that. You know, I was in Chennai, and the power goes off from, what was it, 12 to 2. And the next day it was off from 12 to 2. And I said, why? They said, oh, every day they turn off the power for 2 hours. This is in the cities. Then one day it was off all day. Oh, today it's off all day. Oh, yeah, one day a month it's off all day. Oh, which day? Oh, they don't tell us, just random. Just... And then it was the first day of the next month, and all of a sudden the power turned off at 10 and went back on at noon. And I said, today it was 10. They said, yeah, at the beginning of the month they switch it. Well, do you know? Which? No, they don't tell you. You just notice by when it's off that, okay, it's going to be off. Okay. And this is a city. And I said, you know, in America, if they were going to turn the power off, they'd send you a notice. You know, the power will be off from 12 to 2. No, you just, and everybody's just sort of mellow about it. Oh yeah, there's no power today. So we find in India, although there's still quite a bit of spirituality, I mean, a little, some of it's funny, like the Krishna liquor store or something, but although there's still quite a bit of spirituality, they just don't have sophistication in materialistic activities. Frankly, we have to say, even the agriculture in India now, they're using so many chemicals, so many pesticides and fertilizers and tractors, and I know even in Mayapur, we're farming with pesticides and chemical fertilizers. And when we try to tell the local Bengalis, please don't use these things, they say, oh, that's a Western superstition. They do. They say, you know, you Westerners, you have your superstitions that you have to farm organically. Right? It's a big problem, even on our ISKCON-owned land. So we find that there's the material sophistication is not there. And in the West, we find that the spiritual life is practically absent. I mean, there's some Christianity and some Islam and Judaism and Buddhism, but real spirituality is basically absent. And it's absent by intentional design. So in most of the Western countries, they say, okay, get God out of the schools. No God in the schools. I mean, even in the UK, where they're mandated to have God in the schools, they un-God God. So they have their required collective worship every morning in the UK schools. Like in America, you're not allowed to pray in the schools. I mean, of course, in the Bible Belt, they get away with it. Unless somebody brings a court case. Because I worked for a year in a government school there. And at Christmas time, I was really surprised at Christmas time, the kids did a musical performance. And They were singing real Christian hymns. I mean, the real deal. Of course, they also sang Santa Claus songs and things like that, so hopefully nobody would criticize them. But in the UK, they have their collective worship in the morning, where you're supposed, there by law, you're supposed to do something that's Christian and other UK religions. But most of the schools just talk about values, which means they're talking about Rajagun and maybe a little Sattvagun. They're just talking about, you know, honesty and integrity and things like that. And they read some inspiring story about some man who lost his legs and still ran a marathon race. And that's their collective worship has become like that. So they've even, you know, have God-free worship. And God is systematically, intentionally absent. Systematically and intentionally absent. When we did our Learn to Read books, we reviewed dozens and dozens and dozens of books to teach children how to read from all the English-speaking countries of the world. And we noticed several interesting things, but one of them was that God was systematically absent. So even if there's a little story about Christmas, there's no Jesus. There's a story about Diwali, there's no Ram. You know, there's a story about Ramadan, there's no Allah, there's no Muhammad. It's just, oh, here's how people do this cultural activities, and these people eat idlis, and these people eat turkeys, and these people eat, you know, that was as far as they would go. And here's society. Society means husband, wife, you know, two children, one dog, suburbia, one television, no God. And of course, now they also have that happy life means just single mother or just single father or, you know, whatever. And pretty soon they have other interesting family arrangements in their books already coming. So that in these Western countries where we're very sophisticated about our temporary life, the governments have mandated that there's no God. Now you find a few places in the world where they're trying to do both. Find some places where they're trying to do both sophisticated temporary arrangements and spiritual life. And for me, one of the most notable examples is in the Gulf countries. So when you go to places, Dubai is basically materialistic, but in a place like Qatar or Bahrain or Kuwait, you see this, where they're very sophisticated in their material activities. I mean, beautiful roads, you don't find rubbish on the side of the roads, and expert medical arrangements for people, and I mean, things on the material side are very together, and they also try to have a spiritual atmosphere. You know, they're calling for prayer 5 times a day, and many people are on the road in their religious dress, both men and women, and there's some idea of God consciousness. Of course, their so-called expert material arrangement is a little odd. It's all dependent on oil, on drilling for oil and selling the oil. It's a very strange civilization. They don't have any natural water. They have to desalinate the ocean to have water. So I don't think that model could really be replicated. So what are we looking for? We're looking for something that's both materially and spiritually prosperous. How are we going to do this? This really needs to be our meditation. This really, really needs to be our meditation. And the sad or inspiring thing, depending on how you want to look at it, is that we really can't see very many models around us. You know, there's one devotee in India who keeps asking me, please show me a model of a grihastha couple who's both following the shastras for grihastha life and materially successful. He says, please show me some example. So he followed the shastra and then he got married very young, he had a child very young, but he doesn't know how to maintain himself. He said all the other devotees, they're marrying at 30, 35, and they're only having one kid, and both husband and wife are working. He said that's not the model of a grihastha life. He said, all the grihasthas I know, you know, they're not chanting their 16 rounds anymore, or they don't eat food cooked by devotees. He said, it's so hard to find an example of someone who's sophisticated materially, who's together materially, and who's spiritually enlightened. He said, where can I find such examples? And he lives in a place where there's literally tens of thousands of devotees. And we were trying to find somebody, anybody, who was a good example. Okay, here's somebody who entered the grihastha ashram properly, who's living according to the shastra, who's materially together and spiritually together. You know, we couldn't find anybody. So this is, you know, this is our problem, that when we look for examples, it's very, very hard to find them. It's really, really hard to find examples. It's hard to find examples of a country. It's hard to find examples of a city. It's hard to find examples of a community. You know, sometimes people will say, well, go to an Indian village, and that's an example. And I haven't been to very many Indian villages where I'd really like to live the rest of my life, and where I could really say, okay, here's the model for the world. Okay, everybody in Munich, this is how you should live. I don't think they'd go for it. So that's very unfortunate, but it may also be enlivening, because guess what? We're not going to find the examples. We have to what?
Be
the examples. Ouch. You know, go look around the world for an example. I mean, you'll find some. You'll find some here and there, a few, but not many. Not many. Most people are off balance. Most people, they're, you know, materially successful and spiritually impoverished. Or they're spiritually successful, but they're materially not together. You know, we're trying to build our city in Mayapur to be this example. It's one of the things we're trying to do in Mayapur. But it's not easy. I'm involved with some of the planning groups for the Mayapur city. You know, it's not easy. People tend to be off balance. You know, there's all these buildings going up where they're building six stories on a foundation for three stories, and the building's falling over. You know, they're pushing the ability of the ecosystem to support that number of people in a sane and balanced way. But we're going to have to be the example, and to be the example requires some thoughtfulness and some care. It's easy to be a fanatic. Temporarily. You know, it's easy to be at an extreme. Temporarily. But even most people, frankly, who preach extremes can't live it. Frankly. But how to have a life according to the Ishopanishad where you know both? The Ishopanishad says you have to know both. How do you do that? How do you demonstrate that you're happy materially, you're prosperous materially, and you're going back to home, back to Godhead? I'm not saying I have the answer, by the way. I'm putting this out as a challenge. But this is something that we have to do. And one thing that's interesting is that most of us, if not all of us, are very nicely positioned to do exactly this. And somebody like you, Radhika Raman, are ideally positioned to do this. So those of us who've been brought up in the West, in Western culture, in the sophisticated materialistic culture, we know how to enjoy the material world in a very sophisticated way. We do. We know how to be organized and together. And we're trying then to add spiritual life. We're trying to be then an embodiment in our own person of someone who has Western expertise and spiritual vision. And the same with the Indians who've then come to the West. I see that the Indians who've come to the West are in a really good position, or the Westerners who've gone to India. And those who've been born into the movement are in a perfect position. I mean, I remember when I first met you, what really impressed me was that your English and your Sanskrit were both perfect. I was like, yes, that's what we want. Sanskrit with a perfect accent, you know, English with, I think, a perfect accent. Russ Mundell is not here, so I can't argument. Yeah. And that, I'm sorry to pick on you. I hope you'll come to my classes in the future after I'm totally embarrassing you. But really, I always thought of Radhika Raman Prabhu as just the epitome of this. You're a college professor, and yet you're a Vaishnava. Materially, you're a success. You have your PhD from Oxford. You know, anyone can look at you and say, oh, this person is a material success. This person is very sophisticated in enjoying the material world. And yet at the same time, you have your spiritual life. I thought our education system should be producing thousands of you. Sorry. You won't feel so special anymore. But that's really what we should be producing. Prabhupada talks here about the modern universities that produce hippies. Of course, there aren't really hippies anymore. Now they're worse. Huh?
Hippies.
From hippies to happies. The young people now are much worse than the hippies. At least the hippies. By the way, the hippies never called themselves hippies. That was an outside term others gave to them. The hippies called themselves freaks. Or counterculture. So the freaks. Those people generally had some interest in spirituality. You know, the mood was, and I know because I was there, the mood was, you know, let's give up materialistic culture, something like Dr. Sun's. It was something like this idea. Let's give up this, you know, Kimasat Karma Birbavit, let's give up the materialistic culture. But unfortunately, instead of going to Sattvagun, they went to Tamagun. They rejected Rajagun. They said, forget this Rajagun. But unfortunately, they went to Tamagun. But now it's become much, 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 much worse. Now it's become much worse. I mean, the mood then was that, you know, let's everybody love each other, let's have a united world, and let's go back to a peaceful life, and let's get back to the land. You know, there were a lot of organic communal farms formed at that time, and nowadays it's not like that at all.
It's satanic mass.
Yeah, satanic mass, yeah. Now you go, and I mean, the music we played in the 60s was like, let's love one another, and you know, let's get back to the land. And now the music they play, I mean, I heard some of it on the train from Golok, from Mainz to Munich. So these guys are just there all drinking their beer and playing this music that sounds like animals in the forest. It's like, ooh, is that music or is it wolves? You know, so this modern university system, what is it producing? People are going there and they're having sex like literally like animals. Publicly, with no commitment, like the monkeys in Vrindavan. I mean, there's just no difference at all. Except that they're not in Vrindavan. You know, and they're taking all kinds of intoxicants. And these people are, you know, I never want to have children, I never want to get married. And they're just earning money without even giving a charity. Just let me earn as much money as I can. My son was telling me how in the modern business school, they say the only thing you think about in business is making money. They said you don't do something in business because it'll make the employees happy. You only make, you know, any decision you have, your only question is, will this increase the profit? That's your only question. Won't increase the profit, you don't even do it. If you think about ethics, if you think about morality, if you think about helping your employees or serving the customers, you're never going to make it in business. That's deep tamagun. So this is the university, this is university class in a big university in America for a big business degree. So it's becoming worse and worse and worse. So somehow we have to do it, and it's a challenge. It's not easy. It's not easy. I'm not saying it's easy. But that's what we have to do. We have to show that we are able, that we're happy in the material world. Our philosophy is not suffer in the material world. That is not our philosophy. I mean, you're going to suffer in the material world whether you like it or not. To call it Yama Shashvatam. But Prabhupada says in the 20th chapter of Krishna book that the materialists see everything as very aggressive, and to those who are in Krishna consciousness, everything appears to be happily situated. And Krishna says in the 3rd chapter, by offering yajna, the demigods provide everything, and everybody lives happily and achieves liberation. So this is what we want to show for society in general. This is what we want to show. How can we have a society where people have what they need to be happy in the world, where they can progress in a proper way through the ashrams and come to the point actually of saying kimasat karma birbhavet, both in terms of offering everything to Krishna and yukta vairagya, and in terms of the end of really taking sannyas. So this is our challenge, how to do this. And unless and until we do this, we are not going to form a society. So I say all the time that we've been very successful at ikhan, international Krishna consciousness. We're really good at that. We have spread Krishna consciousness all over the world. I can go to little towns and little villages, and generally you find somebody's chanting Hare Krishna. Very interesting. But we haven't been very good at the ISKCON. How are we going to do the society? I don't think there's only one answer, by the way. I don't believe there's just one answer. I don't believe we're going to say all the 7 billion people on the planet are all going to just, you know, start a farm. Because even in Krishna's time, there was Warka, there was Hastinapur. There has to be a way to have Prabhupada wanted Mayapur as a city. We have to have a way to have ecologically sustainable cities. We have to be able to present something to people that you're going to be just as happy in this way, materially, as you are now, even happier. And you're going to achieve liberation, both. What is it here? Bandha Moksha, both. So I see this as our main preaching challenge. Yes, Prabhu.
Well, Nimrajadama is a very good example.
Mm.
I think of all the places I've seen. Their housing is European standard. And your deity worship is wonderful. Many good examples there. As far as not finding good examples otherwise, you know, the problem is that our devotees, they live in two cultures. They're predominantly in the material culture.
Mm.
And because that's where their economic sustenance comes from, that's where they put most of their energy.
Mm.
So in Alachua one time, one devotee commented in class, we've noticed that the only devotees that come to Mangalarti are those who either have full-time devotional service or those who are independently wealthy. And it's a fact that we see that the devotees who have devotional service in which they are economically sustained, like BTG or BBT, that they're the steadiest devotees that we have in our society. They're steady spiritually, and of course they're not, you know, asking for, you know, opulent living, but they have a reasonable standard of material life as well.
They have a comfortable standard.
Yeah.
Well, I really like your point about having some devotional means of living. And I'm going to be really controversial here. I think we've really shot ourselves in the foot in this regard. Because it was at our education conference, I think, where we asked people running a particular project, do you pay your teachers? And he says, no, they all work for free because it's devotional service. So I see that we have a tendency, and I'm saying we, I'm including myself. We have a tendency that, you know, if a devotee is going to fix our plumbing, we want them to do it for free, or we want them to do it at one-tenth the cost. But we're just completely fine to pay a non-devotee full price to fix our plumbing. We have no problem with that at all. So we really haven't worked at developing an economically sustainable model where we keep our wealth circulating within our communities and maintain ourselves. So I see that as just as much of an important example as having something like Nivrajadam, something where our wealth keeps recirculating, and that would be both through money and through barter, where we really try to help each other to sustain each other economically. And I like your point that where a person is getting their economic maintenance from has a lot to do with how much they're able to be steady with spiritual life. I see that with schools too, like here Prabhupada was talking about universities. But as, you know, someone who ran a primary and secondary school in the movement for 18 years, what I saw was as soon as the parents had their kids in outside schools, generally, not always, but generally, their participation would decrease.
Decrease
in the temple, generally. Because all of a sudden they're driving their kid to school, then they're driving their kid to soccer practice, and they're driving their kid to gymnastics, and they're driving their kid to that, and that, and the other. And that was where their energy went. And often their money would go to the school, their time would go to the school, their energy would go to the school, and their commitment to the community and to the program would decrease. I mean, you can see it over and over and over again. The kid was in the Gurukula, and everybody's at the morning program, and everyone's contributing to the community. They put their kid in outside school, and within 2 months, we didn't see them anymore. That the children drew the family away. So, yeah, like Jesus said, wherever your treasure is, there will your heart be also. Prabhupada said this to Ambarish, your heart will be where your money is. So where your money is, where your children are, that's where your heart goes. And then it becomes very, very difficult. Of course, there are some devotees who have outside jobs who do worship in their home. But also on a practical level, you know, most jobs you've got to be at 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock in the morning. I mean, when I was doing my internship, I had to be at work at 7:20 in the morning. So if you have to be at work at 7:20 in the morning, how are you going to come to the full morning program? You can't. So we started having a little discussion about this recently on the Scholars Conference, so it didn't go very far. But that in many ways, our lifestyle is monastic. To say to people to go from 4:30 to 9:30, 5 hours every morning, how are you going to do that? If you're going to a university, unless you go to this university. You know, but if you're going to a university or you're going to a job, how are you going to go to a morning program from 4:30 to 9:30 every morning? You can't. You just physically can't do it. You just can't. If you've got to be at work at 8 in the morning, you've got to get your kids out for the school bus at 6:30 or 7 in the morning, and you've got to get out to... So I really see that many times our attitude that, you know, I don't want to hire a devotee. I don't want to pay a devotee anything. I don't want to sustain a devotee. I'd rather pay a non-devotee. We make it very difficult then for our members who desperately would like to work with devotees to do so. And, you know, for our children growing in the movement who'd like to have jobs with devotees. Oh, and the other interesting things that we do that shoot ourselves in the foot as far as having an economically sustainable community is, let's say you have a devotee business that hires devotees. And I know my husband had such a business, my son ran such a business. So from the point of view of the employees, they often misuse this. You know, instead of thinking, okay, I have a job. Okay, it's a job with devotees, and we're selling prasadam or, you know, whatever, that it's a job, they think, oh, it's devotees. Oh, it's devotees. So, oh, Prabhu, my Guru Maharaj is in town. I'm not going to be here for 3 days. Goodbye. You know? Oh, it's Narottama Das Thakur's appearance day. I'm coming in late to work today. Prabhu, I'm sure you understand because you're a devotee. You know, and I'm going to India for 2 months. See ya. You know, and you'd never be able to do that at a job. So we have that problem from the employees, and then after a while people say, God, I never want to hire a devotee. You know, I've heard this all over the world. I'm never going to hire a devotee. They just go to India for 2 months. You know, goodbye. And then on the other side, I've seen the, you know, abuse on the other side. I don't want to use the word mistreatment on the other side, where I met some devotees. I can't say too much about this, it'll be obvious what I'm talking about. So how do I say this without being obvious what I'm talking about? Anyway, I met some devotees who were doing a career where there is facility to work with devotees. So I said, why are you working for the non-devotees? They said, well, we used to work for that devotee program. But they said, Prabhu, this is service. So you have to work 7 days a week, 12 hours a day, because this is your service. They said, now that we work for the non-devotees, we have time for our sadhana. We have time for our families. We have time to do some preaching. They said, when we work for the devotee company, we were struggling to chant 16 rounds. So, you know, again, I see when we talk about creating a society that maybe we need to start dealing with each other a little differently. Maybe we need to start dealing with each other with as much respect and sophistication as the non-devotees who set good examples do. You know, if you've got employees working for you in a devotee business, treat them as you would treat non-devotee employees. If you have an employer, treat them with the same respect and consideration. Pay people what you would pay them. Give them the facility you would give them. And then we'll start to build a society. So I see we need to do that in addition to farming with oxen. You know, it's not just, okay, let's go to the land and farm with oxen and not have any electricity and just light with candles. You know, that's nice. But again, I don't think we're going to get the world to do that. I really don't. I mean, maybe if everything collapses and everybody has to light with candles, that's another thing. But I don't think we're going to convince everybody in Munich or Brussels, you know, okay, get rid of your electricity and just light with candles and don't use the internet anymore and don't have your smartphones and travel by ox cart from one place to another. I don't think we're going to, I don't think that's going to happen. We need both of those examples. But anyway, thank you for bringing that up. The idea of what we're doing to maintain ourselves really affecting our spiritual life is very, very, very crucial. And it's something we need to think. We don't need to, I mean, but if we'd like to spread the Hare Krishna movement all over the world, then we need to. If we just think about ourselves, then we don't need to think about it at all, I suppose. But even for ourselves, most of us really struggle with this. One of my seminars is called Material and Spiritual Balance. It's one of my most popular seminars. People ask for it all over the world. It's very well attended. Any other questions? Comments? Yes? I hope you're all right that I used to. You're all right. I'm sorry.
Thank you for your clear reminder that spiritual advancement doesn't entail material poverty or failure. But at the same time, I guess the question is, what do we do about, you mentioned this briefly and I was hoping you could elaborate more on it, what do we do about the call towards tapasya and austerity, which is so strong and so clear, even in this story here, where Prabhupada's purport is kind of unusual in the context of this story, where the general tenor of his purports and the verses is leave and give up and what apparently looks like material impoverishment.
Okay, what do we do about the call for austerity and material impoverishment? You put those people as the heroes of your society. They become the heroes. Right now, our heroes in materialistic society are generally the most degraded people. You know, here's some entertainer, they've had, you know,
I've had 20,000 girlfriends.
You know, and they're the heroes. There was one basketball star who actually said that. You know, so they're the heroes. These are the people are worshiping. The sports people and the, you know,
I make $1,700,000 an hour by cheating everybody in the banking business.
There is actually somebody who makes that much money. So that's not made up. So these are our modern heroes. You know, who are the heroes? The heroes are all Shudras. They're not even Shudras, actually. There, Prabhupada called them sixth class. He said the fifth class people earn their livelihood by hunting in the jungle, and the sixth class people earn their livelihood through criminality. So our heroes are really people who are very, very degraded. So replace that. Just like in our Hare Krishna movement, our heroes are the sannyasis. When I teach sociology of religion, one of the things we talk about is class stratification and status in society. So in most societies, status is by what you call socioeconomic status, which has three factors. How much money do you have and make? How much education do you have? And what kind of occupation do you have? Do you have a high status occupation? So like college professors have a high status occupation and the highest level of education, but not the highest income. So it's interesting that in our Hare Krishna movement, the people with the highest status in our society are the renunciates. Those are the people to whom we give the highest status. And even among the grihasthas, we give the highest social status to people who are living lives of total dedication and austerity. So that's one way that you do it. You switch who are the heroes and the villains in society. And even, of course, in Vedic society, there were kings who were also heroes in society, who were great sense enjoyers, but also using everything in the Lord's service. So this is, then of course you go to Varnashram, where everybody in the, each Varna has its particular kind of tapasya. It has its kind of tapasya. Okay, you're a Kshatriya, all right, you can have 10 wives and 30 concubines, but if any woman comes to you and surrenders, you have to accept her. That's a pretty heavy tapasya. It is. And you have to take care of her. You can't just, you know, put her on your list as my, you know, 19,973rd girlfriend, but you got to take care of all those women. You got to give them, not just do you take care of them with money, you have to take care of them with affection. Otherwise, you're going to end up like Chitraketu. You know, you have to, there's a tapasya that goes along with it. And yes, you can conquer the land, but you got to be in the front of the battle. You can't be in your office just pressing buttons. So each varna has its tapasya. You know, whether you're a Shudra, whether you're a Vaishya, whether you're a Kshatriya, whether you're a Brahmana, there's a kind of tapasya. And the tapasya doesn't always mean that you don't have money, and the tapasya doesn't always mean that you only have cold water or you don't have any furniture. But each varna has its tapasya, and each ashram has its tapasya. You know, of course, the ultimate tapasya is for everybody. The ultimate tapasya, which, again, I'm going to be very frank, that most of us in the Hare Krishna movement seem to really have a problem with, is to give up your false ego. That's the real tapasya, frankly. That's a much heavier tapasya. Like Krishna says of sacrifices, I am japa. That's a heavier tapasya than chanting 16 rounds every day, or not having illicit sex, or not taking drugs. Or, you know, generally, even among the devotees, we ardently, enthusiastically, with great vigor, defend our false ego all the time to everybody. Me make a mistake? Not me. You're the one who made a mistake. I never make any mistakes. I'm right. You know, so that's the real tapasya, ultimately, is Sarvapati Vinirmuktan Tadparti. And that everybody has to do. It doesn't matter whether you're Brahmachari, Grihastha, Vanaprastha, Sannyasi, or it doesn't matter if you're not in any of those. You know, you're a thrice divorced 45-year-old with 10 children from your 3 marriages, and you're working in a bank in the financial industry, you know, so you don't really fit anywhere. So even if you're like that, you have to give up your false ego. That's heavy tapasya, because we think that's who we are. You have to give up your false identity. That's the real tapasya. And instead of chanting your own glories, you have to chant the glories of the Lord. Yes?
Oh, he's asking about austerity, but in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna gives austerities of speech and body and the mind. And those austerities are not... It's very difficult for devotees. Right? Austerity of the body, to worship the spiritual master, spirits like father or mother, to speak truthfully and so on like that. So these austerities, are not...
This is a great sadhu who says that they're not difficult.
For one in sattva,
they're not difficult. But I really like that you're bringing out the threefold austerities of the body, mind, and speech. And of course, Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur says that the body is the least difficult, and then the speech is the more, and the mind is the more. But those are actually, if you're not in Satvagun, to always be satisfied, mentally satisfied, to only speak things that are beneficial to others, that's hard. Most people think that if I think it's true, then I can say it. Never mind if it benefits others or not. So those are also hard. But that's a very good point. Thank you. Wow, thank you. So glad you're here. So that's also, that austerity is there. And that can be encouraged. Those are the austerities we're really interested in. You know, we're not really, really very interested in the austerities of sitting in cold water up to your neck in the winter. That's not our process. And in fact, those austerities without bhakti just make your heart hard. In fact, we're not, there's a whole section in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. You know, that what about Gyan and Vairagya? And Gyan and Vairagya are not angas of bhakti. They're natural results of bhakti, but they're not causes of bhakti. They're not angas of bhakti. And yeah, these austerities in goodness, and these austerities of giving up the false... Basically, all those threefold austerities are different ways of manifesting giving up the false ego. That's really what we have to do. And that's the hardest thing. You know, it may seem very hard in the beginning to walk around with tilak on your face in Western countries. You know, and I've been deeply admiring all the men who have a shaved head and shika in Western countries. I mean, I've been really deeply meditating on how much of a tapasya that is to do that in Western countries. you know, to walk around in these funny clothes in the West. I mean, that's, in the beginning, that seems like a huge austerity. It may seem like a huge austerity. I mean, when I first visited a temple when I was 14, and I saw the sign Prabhupada had written, you know, only eat food cooked by devotees, I was like, wow. That's, whoa. I don't know if I want to do that. Now, that's a huge austerity, which, frankly, a lot of devotees don't do. Don't eat at Pizza Hut and whatever. But none of those things hold a candle to give up your false ego. I mean, they're not even close. And we find all these great yogis who, you know, they do meditate in the water and they meditate in the sun, but they don't give up their false ego. They keep that. So, of course, as Ravindasri Prabhu says, in the beginning that's very painful, but gradually as you give up your false ego, what was painful becomes delightful. Because you realize that all your suffering is due to the false ego. And that's what we should be saying every day, Kimasat Karma Bir Bhavittu. Every day. What is the use of this false ego? What is the use of this false ego? What is the use of this pride? What is the use of it? What a stupid, useless piece of rubbish it is. Let it die. The sooner it dies, the better. And if somebody comes and attacks it, thank you for helping to kill off this disgusting thing that is keeping me from everything that I want. So. Okay. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.